everyone, welcome to another episode of What the Hal, and this week, we're talking about something that happened decades ago. It's when three Americans, Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, and Buzz Aldrin, got into the Apollo 11 spacecraft, took off, landed on the moon, and made those very small first steps, or, as Neil Armstrong said, giant leaps. This week, we're talking with Garrett Reisman. He's another astronaut. He's a guy that was influenced by that mission to the moon. For an astronaut like you, that's gotta really mean something.
Oh, it sure does. So I can't believe it's 50 years, but because then it makes you also realize how old you are.
How old are you?
I'm 51, so I was 1 year old when Apollo 11 landed on the moon. So I don't have any memories of the exact event, but I have memories of watching it over and over and over on film. And I was fascinated by that, and watching those films, and I read everything I could about it. That really inspired me to go off, become an engineer, and eventually become an astronaut.
What fascinated you about that?
The adventure of it, and just the life experience of going out there, and also I was always, I guess, fascinated by the engineering it takes to safely negotiate like a really hazardous environment. So that was probably the strongest example was like I was fascinated by how they decided to dock the lunar lander to the command module and do a lunar orbit rendezvous and just all the mechanisms. I was the kind of kid that when my parents took me to the zoo, I was much less interested in the animals than I was in the cages. How do they feed these lions? How do the cages work? How do they open and close the doors? I was always, you know, really interested in the mechanisms more than the animals.
You did a couple of spacewalks and mm-hmm. Spent time at the International Space Station, and we can get into that a little bit, but I sort of wondered, in light of the three guys that first went to the moon, I'm sure there were trepidations, I'm sure there were anxieties. When you went out in space, were you scared?
Nah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If you could only have seen his face just now.
Yeah, there were definitely times that I was scared. When you're launching, you realize that's a pretty critical moment, and especially when you think about accidents that have happened. So yeah, when the SRBs came off the shuttle, and I knew that you know, you think about Challenger, and I realized that risk was behind me. That was a good feeling.
The SRBs, are those the tiles?
Oh, sorry. No, those the solid rocket
boosters. Oh, the boosters. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
Was the problem for that's what caused the Challenger accident, those boosters leaking past the O-rings. So once you get to the point where those came off and you realize that was not an issue anymore, you kind of are aware of that. And the same thing coming home, when we passed the point in the trajectory where Columbia broke up, you kind of know that you're going through that moment. So there are times like that you have, but most of the time, what you're really focused on as an astronaut is doing your job. And so what you're afraid about more than bodily harm is that you might make a mistake, and you don't want to be the cause of a problem.
When we fly on an airplane, We pretty much take that for granted anymore. You get on the plane, you get in your seat. For me, if I get a window seat, I get my phone up so I can get a nice shot of the plane taking off, put it on Facebook so we can see it. It's a big social experience. However, I think we take flying for granted when we fly airport to airport and that sort of thing, especially if you've done it since you were a child. That's not exactly the same experience as going out into space, although there are probably some residual feelings of like flying in an airplane.
It is, and it's really interesting to make that comparison, because if you think about it, if nobody flew in airplanes and somebody got to go fly in a 747 or something and they came back, they would be doing podcasts about it. You know, they'd be being interviewed on television. They would say, "What was it like? What was it like when you looked out the window and you saw the houses get so small? What did it feel like when you took off? What was going through your mind?" You know, that's what we would want to know. But we all do it. So now people get on the airplane and, you know, they settle into their seat and they whip out their device and they're playing Angry Birds or whatever, and they've closed the window shade. They don't even look out the window. They don't even notice when they take off or land.
See, I like the feeling of flying through clouds. I love to be able to take my phone, and thank goodness they let us, you know, take pictures on airplanes. But I love the feeling of moving down or moving up into a clouded area and then getting video of flying in and through the clouds. I don't know what it is about that, but that does something to me.
Well, it me too. And what's really fun is if you're piloting the plane and you could play with the clouds. So when you're in that you know, in between the cloud layers or coming in and out of them, and you could, like, I love to, when I fly my plane, I love if there's a cloud and there's a little hole in it, I love to pretend I'm the Millennium Falcon shooting, you know, at the door of the Death Star. And being able to do that, the reason we love it so much is it gives you some sensation for the speed, which is otherwise absent.
Well, you know, I think I've heard people say, and I think this is true, when you get on a flight and you have turbulence, well, that's really actually flying. I mean, if everything were smooth, it'd be like a conveyor belt.
Yeah.
But by actually bouncing around some like a bird, right, you really are flying and you really get that sensation. So instead of getting scared of turbulence, which I think we all do, I get a little freaked by it, but I try to think, oh, what it must be like if you're a bird.
Yeah, with my kids, when we're in our little airplane, I tell them that's just airplane dancing.
Oh, is that what that is, an airplane dance? I'll try to remember that.
Airplane's dancing.
Yeah. I'll try to remember that next time I'm flying.
But going back to thinking about what it's like how people are so nonchalant when they fly in airplanes. They don't even, you can be right over the Grand Canyon, nobody bothers to look out the window. You know, the interesting thing is I think one day we'll be that way in space.
You
know, Yeah, I hope we do. I hope that one day we'll be launching people in rockets, and as they sit there on the launch pad, they'll be closing their window shades and, you know, playing with their phones or whatever. I think we're going to get to that point someday where it becomes so routine that people launch into space and don't even bother looking out at the Earth.
That's a pretty remarkable thought. So let's go back five decades to the sixth decade of the 20th century, the 1960s, 1969. These three guys, Collins, Armstrong, and Aldrin, all get up after having breakfast, get in their suits, start walking over to the pad. And the adventure begins.
Yeah.
And what an adventure it was.
Yeah, you know, wow. I mean, it was really great to later, many, many, many years later, to go out that same door and suit up in that same room and go out there. But it must have been so different for those guys doing something that, you know, there was so much that they didn't know. There's so much risk and doing it for the first time. But knowing Neil Armstrong, I think he probably was less impressed than I was.
Well, you know, I got to tell you something. I've met a few of these astronauts, including you. I've known you for a long time. But I've met Alan Shepard. I was starstruck. Alan Shepard.
Yeah.
And John Glenn. And I was starstruck. And Buzz Aldrin. And I was starstruck. I mean, these guys, to me, they're heroes. They're pioneers.
They are. And when it's a good opportunity now, 50 years later, to look back and kind of really appreciate the courage that it took for them to do what they did. It's really just a whole different level than like what we experienced on the space shuttle. And you know, because the things that they were trying to do were so much harder. I mean, going to the moon, given the technology of the time. There were so many. I talked before about how John Glenn, the doctor, came up to him and said, "Hey, you know, we don't know if your heart's going to work when you're up in microgravity. We don't know if you're going to be able to see anything because your eyeballs might deform." And his response was, "Okay, I'll let you know when I come back how it worked out." So, I mean, the kind of things that they were facing were just leaps and bounds above the stuff that we were doing.
Is it, and you probably can answer this from your own experience, what, it's kind of like when you go into surgery, you sign a form that says you could die, you could do this could happen, that could happen.
Yeah.
Do you do that when you get into the spaceship and up you go? Do you sign off on some paperwork that says, you know, you might not come back?
No, you don't have to. There's no informed consent. It's your job, so you kind of have to. You're expected to know that. It is what we're doing actually now. When we talk about space tourism, we're using that model of informed consent, just like somebody going in for a medical procedure. That there are forms that if you buy a ticket, for example, on Virgin or Blue Origin or one day SpaceX, and you're going to go fly in space as a tourist, They will give you a form and say, yeah, these are all the things that could happen. You might lose pressurization and
your eyes might bust. Your heart may break in half.
You might crash. Right. You might explode. These are the different things that can happen. And then you sign at the bottom line, like, I'm aware of all these things and I want to do it anyway. And just like you do for going in for surgery. And so we will do that. But when you're a government employee and it's your job, then no, we didn't sign that. I do remember that they told us that just to be aware that your insurance policy probably doesn't cover this.
You know, that's probably right. I hadn't thought about that. Were you married at the time?
I was married at the time. Yeah. I got a funny story about that.
Go ahead.
I remember John Young, who was one of the Apollo astronauts that walked on the moon, gave us a briefing when we first went down to be interviewed to become an astronaut. And he brought this up that, oh, by the way, your insurance won't cover this. but he brought it up in his very typical, serious, very dry humor kind of way. And I came back home, and I was waiting for the call to find out whether or not I had made it. I knew I was a finalist, so I knew that there was I was going to get a call someday that was going to say yay or nay. And the phone rang, and I picked it up, and I was a little jumpy. And the person on the line was trying to sell me insurance. It was a salesperson and a solicitor. And they said, yeah, we got this life insurance. And they started going through their spiel. And they went through, all the way through their thing. And halfway through the pitch, I said, excuse me, can I interrupt for a second? Does your policy, does this cover flying in space? And the salesman said, what? And I said, like on the space shuttle. And I just heard click. I got a solicitor to hang up on me.
Instead of the other way around.
A telemarketer hung up on me. And
wow.
So for all of you listening out there, feel free to use that.
I may start using that one. That's pretty good.
But I was thinking about it. It was on my mind because of John Young.
Tell me, as long as we can have you here, tell us a little bit about what it's like to become an astronaut. There may be kids out there listening to this who might someday like to become an astronaut.
Oh, yeah, sure. So one thing I tell people is that there's no one way to become an astronaut. NASA picks people that have a variety of different backgrounds. And in fact, it was the realization that you didn't have to just be that not everybody is a test pilot that goes into space that led me to actually submit an application. I was always fascinated by flying in space. I watched the Apollo 11 movies over and over, like I said, but I never thought I would actually do it. If you asked me when I was a kid, what am I going to be when I grow up? I would have said maybe engineer or doctor. I never would have said astronaut. Because I had a mom who was scared of flying. And I don't mean like flying on F-16s. I mean flying on like United. So the thought of like me becoming a test pilot was just not an option, okay?
So when you where do you go to apply, I want to be an astronaut? You look up the ad in the newspaper and it says astronaut wanted.
No, it's actually what you do is you fill out a government standard form for government employment.
Oh, really?
I think it's the SF-171A if I remember that right. Form, it's the same form you fill out if you want a job like in the post office or something. It's just in block 9, instead of writing post worker, you write astronaut.
Weird.
And you fill it all out and you send it to NASA. And I resolved when I was in college, I learned that they weren't just picking test pilots, and maybe it was possible. And then for the first time, I got serious about maybe I could do this as a job.
So they took you up on it. They interviewed you like any job,
yes.
Right? You passed the interview, and then what happened?
So you don't realize you passed the interview. So I went in there, and at the end stages of the process, it's very subjective because it's really at that point on paper everybody is qualified, and really it's just a matter of figuring out like who do you want to hang out with, who do you want to spend a couple months in a tin can with, right? It's more like picking a roommate than it is like a job interview, and so it's very hard to discern. Like people ask me all the time, why did they pick me? I don't know.
Why did they pick you?
Yeah, I don't know. There were 20 people in the group that I interviewed with, and I thought I would have put myself somewhere in the middle or the bottom of the list. I mean, I saw some other people in my group that I thought were incredibly qualified and were definitely going to make it. And then at the end of the day, they picked one of us, and it was me. And that was a huge surprise to me. And the only thing I could say that might explain it is I had a strategy. And my strategy was when I walk into there's an interview, and that most of the week that you're down there, you're it's medical exams, and they have to check everything, and they check a lot more than I ever would have wanted them to, but the one key moment is the interview, and you walk into that room, And it's mostly all the senior astronauts. And John Young was the person that was sitting at the top of the at the head of the table. And my objective now, John Young, he flew the first flight with Gus Grissom of Gemini. He then went on and flew two missions to the moon, Apollo 10, and then later he would go back and walk on the moon. He then was the first commander of the space shuttle. So this guy is kind of like, he's like an astronaut's astronaut. He's done it all. And he, I knew he was not going to be impressed with the fact that I was captain of my high school wrestling team, okay? So my objective...
I didn't even know that, actually.
What, that I was
captain of your high school wrestling team?
That John Young was
Wait a minute,
on.
Hold on. One, two, three. Okay.
Yeah.
I win.
Yeah. So I never, my wrestling career never really took off. But anyway, I'm in there. And so I came up with the objective. My strategy was just try to make John Young laugh. And I accomplished that. I didn't even know. It turns out he...
Would you tell him a space joke?
No. He just asked, I sat down. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but that was what I was. That was my objective. And I walked in there and he said, how's it going? That's how we started. And I said, well, this is going a lot better than my last job interview. And he said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, my last job interview was with TRW, which is now Northrop Grumman. It's here in Redondo Beach. And I walked in, and what I did was I was a grad student at Caltech, and I was worried about the traffic in L.A., all right? And I was worried I was going to be late for my interview if I came from Pasadena. So I spent the night at my girlfriend's place, at my girlfriend's parents' place in Palos Verdes. Okay. So I did all that. I thought I was being really smart about it until the morning of my interview when I went to my suitcase to get dressed and I realized I forgot my pants.
Oh, God.
So I told John Young. John Young said to me, how's this going? And I said, much better than my last interview. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, at least this time I remembered my pants.
That, you know what, for anybody who's got a job interview coming up, wear your pants. Wear your pants.
Wear pants is definitely, especially in this day and age,
good
advice.
So you get the interview, you get the gig, what happens next? A lot of training, exercising,
First of all, there's months in between that. So you have the interview, and then you wait. And the only other indicator about how things are going for months is they take about twice the number of people that they're going to hire, and they do a security background check. So if the FBI – it's the one time you want the FBI to come around and knock on your neighbor's door and ask questions about you, because that means that you now have about a 50-50 shot. And so if that happens to you, then you know it's a flip of a coin. And then you can imagine just the anticipation, and one day the phone rings. And it was in my office.
What'd they say?
First of all, you know, you kind of know that depending on who calls you, it's either good or bad. And the guy that called me was a guy that usually calls the thanks but no dice calls. And so I thought, oh, this is bad news. But then after they just asked me, like, oh, how are things? Yeah, it started out very innocuous, right? And I'm like, come on, get to the point. And then he said, and then after a little while of shooting the breeze, he says, well, how would you like to come on down and work for us? And then I went nuts.
I'll bet.
I started screaming. All the people from the other offices came running over. They thought somebody was hurt. And it was all the commotion. And I remember going out to our group's secretary, because they started to tell me logistics. They said, okay, we need you in Houston on this date and bring, you know, a toothbrush or whatever. So I wanted to take some notes and write this stuff down because I'm not thinking straight. So I went out to our group secretary and said, I need a pen and a paper. And she said, well, would you like a legal pad? Would you like graph paper? I'm like, just give me a paper. Any piece of paper. And then I hung up the phone, and that was one of the best nights of my life.
I'll bet it was. So lots of training, lots of exercise, lots of getting physically fit, right? Uh-huh. And then how long before you hear what your first mission is going to be?
Well, for me, it took a long time. So my class, we had to wait a long time. We all waited almost 10 years before we flew.
That long?
Yeah. Wow. And that was atypical. Usually, I mean, some of the guys, it's just luck. I mean, some of the people that were selected earlier flew within a year or two of being selected. There's one guy that the first time he ever went to a space shuttle launch, he was strapped in.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so some people it happened very quickly. But for my class, what happened was They picked a class that was the largest class of astronauts ever because they were spooling up for the space station. And they called that class the Sardines because they were, as they were going through training, they had to be packed into these classrooms and there was no room for them. So we knew that it was going to be a long wait for us. And the class before you kind of tries, at least, to try to foist a nickname or kind of name the new class, usually in a derogatory fashion, right?
I'm sure, yeah.
So they wanted to call us the Dodos.
Oh, nice.
Because a Dodo is a flightless bird.
Yeah.
And we were going to be waiting a long time without a flight. We all knew it because we had to wait for all the sardines to fly. And we didn't Dodo, it was okay, the flightless thing, but the extinct thing was a bit insulting. So we changed the name to the Penguins. So they accepted that. So we were the Penguins. And we did have to wait a long time because not only did the space station take longer than expected, you know, there were delays in the schedule. So we all had to wait for the slots to materialize on the space station. But also then we had Columbia. And when we lost Columbia, we grounded the fleet for a couple years, and so we had to wait for that. All of us flew after Columbia. So so in the end, it ended up taking a long time, and about 10 years. In that 10 years, we were doing some amazing things. We were having some incredible experiences training, flying T-38s. I lived in the bottom of the sea for 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
In sort of a submersible? Is that,
yeah.
Yeah, like a submarine or something?
Yeah, NOAA. They operate a research station on the
down the floor of the ocean. Wow.
Yeah, off the Florida Keys.
You know, I got to tell you, I would probably be a big baby. Because I'm not necessarily, I'm adventurous, but, I can get a fear of heights and things like that. But I think that, I think that it's pretty amazing what you astronauts do and what you accomplish and doing it in a vacuum of space and the risk that you face and the dangers, and you might not come back to your family and it, but that's what the job entails is getting out there and plowing through space and being adventurous and learning. And it's really about learning, isn't it? It's about getting information, learning more about what we don't know a lot about.
Absolutely, yeah. It's all about discovery, learning, figuring out how to live in space, and hopefully paving the way. Hopefully these are just the first small steps, the very first small step. Neil Armstrong's thing got us all rolling, but every little bit that we figure out along the way is leading to the way where we're living, not just on this planet. And I think that's really essential for the survival of the species. I mean, if you take a very big picture view of what we're trying to do here, if we all stay on this planet, one day that's going to come to an end. We were joking earlier before the podcast about how the reason that the dinosaurs went extinct was they didn't have a space program.
They didn't have a plan B.
There was no plan B. And right now, it's kind of like having all of our data on one hard drive with no backup. Right, we have all of our eggs in one basket. You can use whatever metaphor you want, but the truth is that someday something bad is going to happen to the Earth. Either another asteroid is going to collide with us, like what happened with the dinosaurs, or we're perfectly capable of destroying this place, and we are doing a pretty good job of it all by ourselves
with global warming.
Yeah.
So as the planet changes...
And by the way, I just want to be very clear about that. I'm not advocating going to Mars so we can continue to pollute this place. And I want to be very clear that there is no place that we know of in the entire universe that is as good for humans to live on as this planet. In a lot of ways, Mars is very enticing, but in a lot of ways it's much harder to live on Mars than it would be to live in Antarctica. And so it's not a plan A to go to Mars, and Earth is not a disposable planet. Plan A is to take care of this place.
Right.
Stop polluting.
Do you have a lot more respect for the planet Earth now that you've been outside of planet Earth?
Yeah. So that was one thing that probably the most impactful thing I saw up there. It was not looking down at the Earth. It was looking at the horizon and seeing how thin the atmosphere was.
Oh, really?
That was shocking. And that actually was really scary because when you... look at the horizon, and you see the thinness. I mean, it looks like the atmosphere compared to the size of the planet is incredibly small. And we think about the sky as being vast and limitless.
Yeah, I mean, my impression was it's just the great vast space out there, that great unknown.
Yeah, know? But the atmosphere, all the air we have to breathe, is this tiny little layer. You can just block it out with your pinky if you hold it at arm's length, and it's it looks like, I mean, the dimensions of that layer of gas that we all depend on as our life support system is about the same as like the shell on an egg. Or the skin on an apple.
That's very, very fragile.
Yeah, and it looks like a gust of wind could come by and just strip it all away, and that's pretty terrifying.
What else have you learned from your space experience that you think is particularly powerful?
That's the most powerful one. You know, just realizing how fragile our planet is, and how easily it would be. Because the other side of that coin is I was thinking about a week later as I was looking out the window again, and I was looking at the ocean, and I was thinking, wow, you know, okay, how thick is that? And the answer is the ocean is about an order of magnitude thinner than the atmosphere. And the atmosphere you can see with your own eyes is tiny compared to the radius of the Earth. The ocean is 10 times tinier. The deepest part of the ocean, the Mariana's Trench, is about 35,000 feet deep. And the atmosphere is kind of hard to say where it ends, but we draw a line arbitrarily at 100 kilometers, and that's about 300,000 feet, okay? So that's 10 times more. So when you think about everything that involves our life support, our home, think about all the fish in the ocean, all the animals, all the plants on the Earth. You think about all the people. You think about the mountains, the lakes, all that stuff. It's somewhere between the bottom of the ocean and the top of the atmosphere. And this tiny little surface coating on what's otherwise a completely dead rock. And if you think about the Earth that way, it seems really fragile.
It does. Yeah. It does. You know, it's interesting because I don't think I've ever thought about it like that. You have the perspective. You've been out there. We haven't been out there, so we don't have that perspective. So we look at it from the other side of the window, and it all looks great big and all that, but it's not, huh?
Yeah, you go stand on the beach, and you look out to the west here, and it seems like that ocean goes on forever.
It
doesn't.
Yeah, it does look like that, though.
It looks like it, but it's very, very, you know, when you take a different perspective, you realize just how finite it is and how we are entirely capable as a species of destroying it.
You know, I find that I feel very lucky to have landed on the career that I landed on, because I feel like, well, even in this moment, I learned so much, and I get to meet people that are interesting and have had very interesting experiences. And yet there are people that are fascinated by the background of broadcasting and things that we have learned over the years. One of the things that you drew my attention to earlier was how it looks to you as an astronaut to see the press on the other side. Mm-hmm. And coming out of the digs you had over there at the Cape and getting ready to go to the launch pad, and all those cameras are out there flashing at you. What was that like?
Well, it's launch day, and you're so excited, and the adrenaline's pumping. But then, you do come out, and in that moment when you walk down that ramp and those cameras are flashing, then you get this kind of, at least I did, you get this kind of deja vu, or this kind of like, you realize, you start flashing back to all the other people that have walked down that ramp, and especially I thought about Apollo 11. I thought about Neil and Buzz and Michael Collins walking down that ramp. And you get this kind of out-of-body experience that is almost like something from Black Mirror or something, mm-hmm. You know, where you're kind of, you get a bit of an imposter syndrome, I guess, in that moment. But you also get a sense of being part of something really big. And that was pretty cool.
Well, you are and have been part of something pretty big.
Yeah.
And that is the truth. And so on this 50th anniversary of the moon landing, your sort of final thought?
My final thought is I really think it's a great opportunity, and I really hope a lot of people around the whole world, but especially here in America, look back and at this moment, which I think is one of the greatest things. Before we walked in for the podcast, we were talking with the cameraman out there, and he mentioned that he thought it was the greatest accomplishment this country has ever made. And You can even go beyond that and say it might be the greatest accomplishment that our species has ever made. And we take it for granted now. You know, we know that Apollo 11 happened. We've all heard One Small Step for Man, the Eagles landed, all that. And we've all seen the films, and now, you know, we've seen Ryan Gosling do it. So we take it for granted as a fact, you know, something that happened. What we don't appreciate anymore, I think, is just how hard it was and how if you look at some of the documentaries that are available now that really probe that and take you back to the time where it wasn't a given that we were going to put a man on the moon and bring him back, and think about how improbable it was and how incredible it was. And I really hope a lot of people reconnect with that.
Incredible? Yeah. There are all kinds of words you could use to talk about how phenomenal, fantastic, extraordinary that mission was. And now 50 years later, we continue to remember it. Thanks for joining us this week. I'm Hal Eisner, and sign up, subscribe, and enjoy all our episodes of What the Hell.